Chicago. They were down 3-2, and so coach Tommy Ivan took a gamble, throwing Plante, a rookie, in there. Plante won his first NHL playoff game with a shutout and then won Game 7-2. He played the first 2 games of the final against Boston, and then McNeil took over. The Canadiens went on to win the series, and in 1953, Plante had his name engraved on the Stanley Cup for the first time. He was in net for the Canadiens 5 cups in a row, from 1955 to 56 to 1959 to 60. And his name was spelled differently 4 different times. Bowman would dress only one of his big goalies, Glenn Hall or Jacques Plante. Whichever guy wasn't playing would sit in the stands and rest and relax. But if either Hall or Plante got hurt or was having a bad game, the team would stall and stall and stall while the other guy would come down from the stands and get dressed. So the NHL changed the rules. Now only dressed goalies can play, unless they're both injured, and then you can dress a third. The final piece of the puzzle was the character of the team. The Blues had character in spades. The Plager brothers, Barkley, Bill, and Bob, were the original Hansen brothers from Slapshot, very tough and very colorful. You didn't want to turn your back on any of them, because you never knew what would happen. And it didn't matter who you were. When owner Sid Salomon fell asleep on a flight home, Bob cut his tie, just as the players did to each other. Not to be outdone, Salomon cut the leg off Bob's suit pants during the game. Bob, being who he was, wore the suit anyway. A team like that needs a leader, and Patrick and Fletcher found another future Hall of Famer to wear the C. Al Arbour played on the Blues from 1967 to 68 through to 1970 to 71 as a veteran player. He was one of the very, very few players who wore glasses. In those days, no one even wore helmets or face masks. He was 34 years old and the captain during the 3-year run to the finals. He wasn't a great offensive player, but he was a warrior in the best sense of the word. In the days of the 6-team league, Arbour was always on the bubble. He started with Detroit in 1954 to 55, but he didn't play much on that cup-winning team. Then he went to Chicago, where he won a cup in 61. He won another in 62 with the Leafs, but he also spent time in the minors and never broke through as a top regular. So he knew about winning, and he knew what a player had to do to make it. When he was nearing the end of his playing career with St. Louis, he was playing part-time. Scotty Bowman used him as an assistant coach. Today, everyone has assistant coaches, but in those days you had only a head coach. When Al coached, the guys weren't going to fool him, because he'd seen everything. And if a guy wasn't playing a lot, he could relate because he'd been there. A lot of great coaches were players who got by as players not on their natural talent, but on hard work and willpower. And Arbour was certainly a great coach. He was behind the bench of one of the great dynasties in NHL history, the 1979-83 New York Islanders. On January 6, 1972, St. Louis was in Philadelphia. The Flyers were leading 2-0. Arbour and referee John Ashley were standing at the top of the ramp leading to the tunnel at the end of the second period, arguing over a 2-minute penalty call. Philadelphia fans started throwing garbage, and one guy dumped a beer on Arbour. Barkley Plager jumped the railing and went after the fan. That led to a brawl, with fans starting to come onto the ice. The Philadelphia police got involved, and there was some back and forth. Al and defenseman John Arbour, no relation to Al, were hit over the head with nightsticks. John needed 30 stitches. A couple of fans and 2 officers were injured. The police went into the St. Louis locker room and tried to arrest the whole team, but settled for Al, wingers Phil Roberto and Floyd Thompson, and John Arbour. The game was delayed while the guys were taken to the police station. Each of them posted a $500 bond, and 45 minutes later, Al was behind the bench without a shirt and tie on. St. Louis won the game 3-2. Hockey was getting rougher, and expansion was a big reason for it. There were 6 more teams to fill a roster of 20 players and 2 goalies. That meant 132 new slots for players. They basically increased the demand for talent on the ice by 100% in 1 year. Not every team could keep up to the league's best, so that brought on more clutching, grabbing, stick work, and fighting to slow things down. When you look back at the bear hugs and the hooking, it's incredible that players got away with that. But we should not lose sight of the fact that there was some truly beautiful hockey played in those days, too. You could clutch and grab all you liked. You weren't going to stop the Bruins when Phil Esposito and Bobby Orr were battling each other for the scoring title. Or the Habs when Beliveau, Cornouet, and the Mihaljevic brothers were on their game. It was far from just goonery out there. And the fact that the Blues could compete with teams like that from day one just shows that if you get the right people in an organization, it's going to succeed. Chapter 20. The Minnesota North Stars. Mike Modano's last NHL contract made him an employee of the Dallas Stars for 1 day. He used that day to retire. When he did, the last active player from the 1980s was gone from the league. When he retired, the last connection to one of the most exciting of the 1967 expansion teams was gone. Modano was also the last of the Minnesota North Stars. When Mike was drafted, everyone expected him to mature into a pretty special player, and that is a lot of pressure, especially for an American kid drafted first overall into a market that knows hockey. Mike was only the second American ever taken first overall. The fact that the first was Brian Lawton, who was also taken by the North Stars, only made the challenge more daunting. Lawton scored his first goal only 19 seconds into his first shift, but never did manage to silence the critics that thought Minnesota should have taken Steve Yzerman, Cam Neely, or Pat LaFontaine, who were all available in that same draft year. That couldn't have been easy for Lawton, and it only made Mike's career harder. But Mike exceeded every expectation. He was very similar to someone like Connor McDavid. He was a big boy, but he could skate as well as anyone I've ever seen out there. He could absolutely fly, and he had incredible vision. The thing about Mike was that he could do everything at full speed. He could shoot from mid-stride, thread a pass in full flight, and get 3 head fakes in after a goalie had already bid on the first one. Sometimes a defenseman wouldn't even react as Mike blew by. He literally would have no idea which way to go. No American player has ever scored more goals or total points. He led the Dallas Stars to the 1999 Stanley Cup, and he is now in the Hall of Fame. He was just a special player. The thing is, if you live in Minnesota, you probably wish a player like that had retired playing for the city that drafted him. When it was announced that Minnesota was getting a team, a lot of people thought it was a sure thing to succeed. Detroit has become known as Hockey Town, but Minnesota is definitely the state of hockey. You could fill an NHL rink with the fans who come out to high school hockey tournaments there, and NCAA hockey is huge. They love hockey, and they know hockey. We all thought of Minnesota as a lot like Canada. And over the years, there were a lot of great teams there. They had some phenomenal players, and a lot of success. They made it to the Stanley Cup Final twice over the course of their 26 years, and drafted some players who more than made their mark on the game. Bobby Smith, Craig Hartsburg, Brian Bellows, Darian Hatcher. One of their most exciting players was a guy who started with the team in their first season, Bill Goldsworthy. He played junior in the Bruins system with Derek Sanderson and Bernie Parent, but never established himself as a regular in Boston, even when they were a last-place team. When he got his chance in Minnesota, he became the team's offensive star, scoring more than a point a game in the team's first postseason and coming within one game of making it to the Stanley Cup Final. He turned out to be good enough to be named to that legendary 1972 Summit Series team. The fans in Minnesota loved him. One thing I remember about Bill was his enthusiastic way of celebrating a goal. It was known in the media as the Goldie Shuffle. Players were a little more conservative in the way they celebrated back then, and even now guys get called out for celebrating too enthusiastically. But I don't blame them. It's so hard to score in today's NHL. It's hard to score 20 goals now, never mind 40 or 50. When a guy scores a goal, I love to see that excitement and jubilation. I got to know Goldie a little when I went to Edmonton. He didn't play much that year due to injuries. And one thing that all hockey players have in common is that we all get old. There was a group of older guys on that team, Ace Bailey, Paul Schmier, Dave Dryden, Bill Flett. They were all great to me. Because Goldie was a little banged up, I got to know him more away from the ice than at the rink, and he was a great guy. He called me kid. That kind of thing means a lot to a rookie. The North Stars coach was a fiery character. You never knew what Ren Blair was going to do. People in Minnesota weren't familiar with professional hockey, and Blair felt he had to coach the fans as much as the players. If the team was bungling a power play, he'd stand on the bench or the boards, turn toward the crowd, and wave his hands and yell at the fans to boo his players. Blair was famous for signing Bobby Orr. In 1960-61, Wren was managing the Kingston Frontenacs of the Eastern Professional Hockey League, EPHL, a Bruins-affiliated team. Harold Baldy Cotton, who was scouting for the Bruins and had been involved with the NHL since playing left wing with the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1925, saw Bobby playing with his Bantam team in Parry Sound. At that time, Boston was building up its farm system and starting to get its hands on some young players. Cotton went to Lynn Patrick and said, "You gotta see this kid." So a group of them, including Blair, drove up to Jenanook, Ontario, to watch Bobby Orr, who had just turned 13, take over the ice for a full 60 minutes. Scotty Bowman, who was scouting for the Canadiens, was there that night too. He thought Bobby was so small that it was hard to figure out how good he'd be, but he also saw that Bobby had the puck the whole night. Scotty sent a report to Ken Reardon, a former Montreal defenseman who went on to scout, manage minor league affiliates, and become team vice president. He told Ken, "You know, Bobby could really move, and he'll be ready to play junior in a year." But Bobby wasn't even in high school, so Reardon replied, "We're not moving guys in public school." In fairness to Reardon, it is absolutely unheard of for a kid in grade 8 to play junior hockey. But Bobby did it. Blair was the point man assigned to get Bobby. In the days before the draft, NHL teams developed young players through affiliated amateur teams. That meant that they could own a kid's rights from the time he was 14. At that age, a player would be invited to sign what was called a C card. Most kids couldn't wait to sign those cards because it guaranteed that at least one of the six teams was going to take a really good look at you. But Bobby's parents were in no rush to sign anything. They wanted him to have as many options as possible. So Blair had his work cut out for him to bring them around. He got the Bruins to sponsor Bobby's Parry Sound team for $1,000 a year. Eventually, he built up enough trust with the family that, in 1962, Bobby's parents signed his C card. Bobby was thrilled. In return, the Orr family got their house stuccoed, his dad got a car, and Bobby got $1,000 cash. He would be playing for the Oshawa Generals, a team Blair had all but built himself. He had also been GM of the world champion Whitby Dunlops, so he knew what he was doing when he helped build the North Stars. In 1963, the NHL began to phase out team sponsorship, and held its first amateur draft of 16-year-olds. By 1969, the draft was universal, and there were no more protected junior players. So by the time I was Bobby's age, the C cards were gone. But you had to be 20 to be drafted to play pro. At 16, I was an underage junior in Sault Ste. Marie. I really got along with my coach, Muzz McPherson, who was a great guy. When Muzz left, he was replaced by Paul Thériault. Paul was very big on positional hockey, which is a very good way to develop players. In fact, when he was coaching for Oshawa and Marty McSorley was with the Belleville Bulls in 1981-82, Marty was playing in an all-star game and Paul was his coach. He was really good to Marty and taught him a ton. Marty just loved him. But without sounding egotistical, I didn't need to start with the basics. I'd been studying hockey all my life. When I was 7 years old and watching Hockey Night in Canada with my dad, he handed me a piece of fool's cap and a pen. He told me to follow the puck on the paper without looking down. It developed my peripheral vision, which in turn helped me develop a more creative approach. I knew where guys were, so I could go where the puck was going to be. That's why Paul Thériault's style of coaching didn't really work for me. I started thinking about going pro, but the NHL didn't draft underage juniors. My agent, Gus Bedali, called the WHA and got me an offer for $80,000 from John Bassett with the Birmingham Bulls. John was building a team full of great young guys like Rick Vave, Michel Goulet, Craig Hartsburg, and Rob Ramage, a collection of future NHL captains, Team Canada players, and Hall of Famers. Paul Henderson was their veteran. I would have loved to play with those guys, but Gus thought the offer was too low. And then he got me an offer from Hartford to play with Gordie Howe for $200,000. That would have been a dream come true, but they pulled it back. The WHA owners were all hoping their teams would fold into the NHL. And since I was underage, they thought I might be out of it. I believe everything happens for a reason. Bassett recommended me to his friend Nelson Scalbania, a wealthy real estate developer from Vancouver who was starting to invest in sports teams. Nelson owned two WHA teams. In 1976, he bought the Edmonton Oilers, but then sold them to Peter Pocklington the next year. Then he bought the Indianapolis Racers on speculation that the WHA would merge with the NHL. He wanted to pump up the value of the league and had decided that his best bet was to buy a good underage junior. That way, the NHL would have to come to the WHA, either to take the teams in or to keep plugging them with money to get the underage kids. Nelson called my mom and dad in June 1978. And along with Gus, we flew out to Vancouver on Nelson's private plane. I was 17, too young for the NHL, but I really wanted to play professional hockey. As soon as we got there, Nelson asked me to go for a run with him. I think it was his way of testing my endurance. Starting all the way back when I was a kid, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I didn't just play hockey. I used to look forward to the summertime because I loved lacrosse and track and field too. I was a huge track and field guy. Even at 10, I was running long distance, 800 meters, 1500 meters, cross country. I trained hard every day and I loved it. We used to drive out to my grandmother's farm every Sunday. And the first thing I'd do is put my running shoes on and take off along the country roads. I'd run for miles and miles. I wasn't doing it to become a hockey player, but it built up my endurance and oxygen intake, or VO2. So did playing box lacrosse, that is, indoor lacrosse. We'd play four games on a Saturday, and then three games the next day. I played almost each entire game, 4 15-minute quarters. That's like 7 hours of lacrosse each weekend. Years later, when I was with the Oilers, Jari Kurri always had the highest VO2, next to Paul Coffey, and Messier was always ridiculously fit. It was just a part of their makeup and a result of their hard work and training. But the difference was my heart recovery time. They took twice as long to recover. I could go, say, 1 minute and be completely recovered in 10 seconds, ready to go back on the ice at a high level, whereas Yari and Paul might take 20 seconds. That was my strength. Back in 86, when I got 8 points against Minnesota, after the second period, Glenn Sather came in and said, "When you want to go on the ice, just go. The door's open." It was the only time in my career that something like that ever happened. Glenn always played me a ton, but that was the only time a coach said, "Just go." So in the third period of that game, I gave myself a 4-minute shift. Athletes today are incredibly conditioned. When I see defensemen playing 30-minute games, it's unbelievable. I can remember Paul Coffey and Kevin Lowe playing 27 minutes. That's 9 minutes a period. You've got to be in immaculate shape to do that. Duncan Keith plays 30 to 31 minutes every single game. That's amazing to me. I was a centerman who played 21 minutes a game. Again, a lot of minutes. 7 minutes a period. That's a lot of hockey. If I played 7, Marc Messier was playing 7, and the third and fourth guys were playing 6. But I see some of these centermen today who can play 8.5 minutes in a period. That may not sound like a big difference, but every additional minute on the ice is one less minute of recovery. It catches up to you quickly. The shape these guys are in is remarkable. Back in 1978, all those years of playing a lot of hockey and skating and running and lacrosse had built up my endurance to a high, high level. So when Nelson and I went for that 6-mile run and I came back fresh, I think it impressed him. That month, we signed a private services contract that I hand-wrote as he dictated it to me on his private plane. It was for 4 years, $550,000 total, with a signing bonus of $250,000. If the merger happened and the NHL refused underage players, I could keep any money I'd already received. It was a good deal, and I was thrilled with the offer. Something most people don't know is that even though I signed that contract with Nelson and went on to play with the Oilers and the WHA, when it folded into the NHL, I came close to going back into the draft. That's because, at first, the NHL owners couldn't agree on a deal to take in the WHA teams. So they called in Lou Nanny, the longtime Minnesota North Stars GM, to meet with the owners on Bill Wirtz's yacht in Florida and hammer out a deal. Nanny was a legend. He was one of the first Americans in the NHL, and he hung in with the North Stars for a long time. If it weren't for him, the team would have moved to Dallas a lot sooner. Lou structured the proposal so that each WHA team could keep 2 players and 2 goalies, but that the rest of the players would be dispersed throughout the league, and underage players like me, who'd signed with the WHA but weren't yet NHL draft eligible, would have to go back into the draft when we came of age. That meant Edmonton wouldn't be able to protect me. Then Frank Griffiths, who owned the Vancouver Canucks, stepped up and said that unless I was allowed to stay in Edmonton, he wouldn't vote for the deal. Sometimes NHL owners get a bad rap, but I think that showed the generosity and the consideration of a man like Griffiths. When Minnesota started out, it wasn't a great defensive team. But by 1978 to 79, when Lou Nanny took over as GM from Blair, he hired Glenn Sonmore, a former tough guy, as coach. Nanny thought he was the best coach the North Stars ever had. Sonmore put his heart and soul into the game. In 1978, Lou drafted Bobby Smith, Steve Payne, Kurt Giles, and Steve Kristoff. This was a strong core group of players. And then, when the Cleveland Barons folded and joined the Minnesota North Stars that same year, they got some more key guys, including Gilles Meloche in goal. Minnesota was already strong up the center. And then in 1979, they drafted Neil Broughton, who, along with Kristoff, was part of the 1980 Miracle on Ice win. Neil played 17 years in the NHL, just one short of 1,100 games, and scored more than 1,000 points. The Stars drafted Craig Hartsburg with their first pick, sixth overall, in 1979. Hartsburg was terrific. I played with him in the Sioux in 1977-78. He'd play with Minnesota for the next 10 years. And if Craig hadn't had such bad luck with injuries to his knees, groin, back, and hip, he might have been another Bobby Orr. Though they didn't draft Dino Cicerelli, they were smart enough to sign him as a free agent when he went undrafted in 1979. In 1980, Sonmore made history when the North Stars faced off against a Flyers team coached by Pat Quinn. As a young player, Quinn had faced a choice between playing minor league hockey and accepting a scholarship. He had asked a high school phys ed teacher in his hometown of Hamilton for some advice. The teacher was Glenn Sonmore. He told Quinn to take the scholarship. Quinn went on to have a solid career as a bruising defenseman and ended up captaining the expansion Atlanta Flames, then quickly became one of the best coaches in the league, winning the Jack Adams Trophy for Coach of the Year in 1980. Part of what he did to earn that honor was coach the Flyers to the longest unbeaten streak in North American sports history, 35 games. That streak ended in Minnesota in front of the largest crowd the North Stars had ever drawn. The North Stars smoked the Flyers 7-1 to keep a 12-game unbeaten streak of their own going. The teams met again in the semifinals. This time, Quinn's Flyers had their revenge and took the series 4-1. By 1981, they made another solid run for the Cup. In the history of the club, Minnesota had never beaten Boston at the Garden. But on February 26, 1981, Glenn Sonmore took Lou Nanny aside and said, "Lewis, I think we got to make a statement here and show them what we're made of." When Nanny agreed, Sonmore told the team, "We're going to fight every one of them every time they look at us." By the end of the game, Minnesota had 5 guys left on the bench, and Boston had 6. They set the NHL record in penalty minutes. It seemed to set the table for the playoffs. Minnesota beat Boston, and then they beat Buffalo. The North Stars then came across Calgary, who had a very good team, and they put the Flames out, which set them up in the finals against the defending champion New York Islanders. They lost the first 2 games on Long Island, but started out playing well in Game 3. The Islanders' Butch Goring recorded a hat trick, including 2 goals right after Minnesota power plays, and it turned the tide. The Islanders took the game 7-5 and won the series in 5 games. But no one was going to beat New York that year. The Isles lost just 3 games in the 4 series they played. Norm Green already had a history of moving hockey teams when he bought the North Stars from George and Norman Gund in the early 1990s. He had bought the Atlanta Flames in 1979 and moved them to Calgary, and he was still a part owner when they won the Cup in 1989. But still, it was a shock when he decided to move the North Stars to Dallas in 1993, not even 2 years after the team had made a Cinderella run to the final, where they had the misfortune of running into Mario Lemieux. Green had his reasons, of course. The Metz Center, the North Stars' rink, was notoriously cold and aging, though players loved it because the ice there was the best in the league. Green claimed to be losing money, and local government was doing little to help make staying look more viable. Green wanted to move the team to Los Angeles, but the NHL already had plans to partner with Disney in Anaheim. Green's next option was Dallas. At the North Stars' last game, fans were carrying signs blaming Norm Green and making their feelings about him pretty clear. Others were tearing up the seats, either to take them as souvenirs or throw them. Today there is an IKEA where the Met Center used to be. But the North Star's legacy has not been erased. Hall of Famer J.P. Parisi was on the North Star's roster in their first season. His son Zach was born there and has gone on to stardom in the league, now playing for the Minnesota Wild, who joined the league in 2000-01 as part of the three-year process of expansion that included Nashville in 1998-99, Atlanta, now Winnipeg, in 1999-2000, and Columbus and Minnesota in 2000-01. It's ironic that, while the Minnesota Sports and Facilities Commission wouldn't spend $15 million to keep the team, it took $285 million to bring the NHL back. But Minnesota fans have not forgotten their first team, and the Stars haven't forgotten their roots either. In 1991, they created a patch to commemorate their 25th anniversary. It featured Bill Goldsworthy in the original green sweater, facing off against Mike Modano in Dallas Black. Chapter 21. The Oakland Seals. Don Cherry has a lot of great Bobby Orr stories, but there is one he calls the greatest. Bobby was killing a penalty in Oakland one night, ragging the puck for over a minute, circling back behind his own net, as no one else could do. There was no way the Golden Seals were going to touch the puck. But then Bobby saw an opening, and he was gone, up the right wing and in on goalie Gary Smith, who I would later play with. He tried to go top corner on his backhand, but Smith got a piece of it. He didn't catch it cleanly, though, and the puck squirted up. By this time, Bobby's momentum was carrying him around the net. But he saw the rebound sort of hanging there, just under the crossbar, so he tapped it out of midair as he skated by. According to Cherry, it was the only time in hockey history that both teams have given a standing ovation. There is a reason there aren't more standing ovations like that. Hockey players are taught to never give up. You may be behind in the game, but anything can happen out there. I'm not blaming those Seals players. I'm sure I would have been impressed too. But if you're standing up to cheer the other team, that's not a good sign. You're probably not going to win a lot of hockey games. Unfortunately, the Seals, or the Golden Seals, as they were called by the time Bobby scored that goal, didn't win a lot of hockey games. They seemed to have problems from the very beginning, and even though they had some solid players on the roster, they never did manage to establish the game in the Bay Area. The 1967 expansion was always about television, and the league's deal with CBS called for two teams in California. Their number one target was, unsurprisingly, Los Angeles. San Francisco was the next obvious choice. That expansion team went to Barry Van Gerbig, godson of the famous crooner and movie star Bing Crosby. A year earlier, Barry had partnered with Crosby, his brother Mickey, and 50 other investors to buy the WHL's San Francisco Seals, who were supposed to play out of a brand new rink to be built when the NHL rejected the Cow Palace as a venue, though the San Jose Sharks would play there decades later. But the rink was never built, and it was decided that the Seals' home ice would be across the bay in the Oakland-Alameda County Coliseum. The Seals had relocated before they had ever played. The Seals also had trouble selling tickets. There were games where the players themselves might have 30 tickets they couldn't give away. Bing Crosby and his famous friends tried to help them out. Peanuts creator Charles Schulz even made a couple of program covers for them. In fact, Schulz went so far as to give Snoopy a number 9 hockey sweater in his comic strip in honor of his friend and favorite Seals player, Bill Hickey. Schulz and Hickey would later open a hockey school together in Santa Rosa, California. Still, Barry Van Gerbig and the investors were losing money. They wanted to sell the team to Vancouver, but the league wouldn't let them. Jerry Seltzer, who owned the original Roller Derby League, put in a great offer, but the NHL owners didn't like his association with roller derby, not to mention his long hair and flashy clothes. Then Charles O. Finley, the owner of Major League Baseball's Oakland A's, met with Bruce Norris and Bill Wirtz and convinced them to sell to him instead. But the organization had its share of respected hockey people, particularly coach Bert Olmsted. Bert had played on the number one line with Elmer Locke and Maurice Richard in Montreal, and was known as a mucker. When he played with Jean Béliveau and Boom Boom Geoffrion, he even told Béliveau to stay out of the corners. He'd dig out the puck instead and send it to the last place he'd seen him standing. Olmsted always seemed to find Béliveau's stick, and when he didn't, he'd chew him out on the bench for moving. Olmsted played in the Stanley Cup final an amazing 11 out of his 14 seasons in the league. He pushed his players hard. Eddie Dorohoy, a tough little center, once said, "If Bert Olmsted was Santa Claus, there wouldn't be any Christmas." Bill Torrey was hired as general manager and would go on to help the Seals gain a playoff berth in their second season in 1968-69 and again in 1969-70. But he didn't see eye to eye with new Seals owner Charlie Finley. Finley had all kinds of ideas that didn't work for hockey. One of those ideas was white skates. After training camp, the trainer came into the locker room and announced to the team, "We've got a great surprise for you guys." In their stalls were white skates. Now, there were quite a few old-school players on the Seals. Senior guys like Harry Howell, Earl Ingerfield, Bill Hickey, and Jerry Eamon. Howell shook his head and said, "I am not going to wear white skates. Those are figure skates." Bill Torrey had warned Finley. He'd said, "Charlie, hockey players don't wear white skates." Finley had replied, "Well, they might if they work for me." When the team later played an exhibition game up in Sudbury, Ontario, Finley showed up with no advance notice. Halfway through the first period, Torrey, who was up in the press box, got a note. Mr. Finley was downstairs waiting to see him. Torrey went down and said, "Charlie, I didn't know you were coming." Finley said, "Where's the white skates I sent you? Nobody's wearing them." "No, they're not." Finley said, "Well, I didn't come all the way from Chicago not to see somebody wearing white skates, so you'd better go and tell them." At the end of the first period, Torrey found Coach Freddie Glover and said, "Go in there and tell the boys that the boss is here and that somebody better come out in white skates." Glover said, "You go in there and tell them." So Torrey went in. "Gentlemen, the man who signs your checks is outside, and he wants one of you to put on those white skates." There was dead silence in the locker room. No volunteers. So Torrey walked around the room and said, "I guess you didn't hear me. I said the man who signs your checks wants someone in here to wear the white skates." He walked out of the room and waited in the hallway. A few minutes later, Gary Jarrett came out wearing the skates. After the game, Torrey found Finley and said, "Well, Charlie, how did you like those white skates?" Finley said, "I didn't like them. They didn't look good on the white ice." And so he got CCM to make up skates in Seals colors, Kelly Green, Wedding Gown White, and California Gold. And actually, other teams then followed suit. Toronto had blue skates made, and the Detroit Red Wings came up with red skates with a white toe. The trouble was that when pucks or sticks hit the skates, they made black marks, so it became a real nightmare for all the trainers. After about a year, colored skates kind of disappeared. Another time, Finley decided that he wanted a live seal for a mascot. He instructed Bill Torrey to find one, saying, "I think fans would really like that." Torrey said, "If that's what you want, let's see what we can do." Torrey's management team had a hard time locating one. But a couple of weeks before the start of the training camp, his PR guy came in and said, "I found a seal at a sea park. Its trainer will bring it over for $500. Torrey said, "As long as he's alive and flaps." anything to satisfy Charlie. On the opening night of the season, right before the anthem singer stepped onto the ice, a guy came out from the Zamboni entrance with his seal on a leash waddling behind. The seal got to center ice, barked, and flapped his flippers for a few minutes, and then suddenly decided to lie down on the nice cool ice. After that, it never moved. The PR guy, with the help of the ice crew, dragged it off the ice. Finley came by the dressing room and remarked, "That looked like a dead seal." Torrey said, "Charlie, we had no way of testing him." "Well, how much are we paying the trainer?" Torrey said, "I think it's $500. "Give him $250 and tell him to get the hell out of the building." Torrey was also forced to spend hours and hours designing team uniforms and brochures. Worse still, despite a clause in Torrey's contract that no player could be traded or moved without his agreement, Finley interfered with the running of the club. In 1970, he wanted Torrey to make a player and money trade with the Rangers. Torrey said, "Charlie, I wouldn't be a good general manager if I agreed to that. It'll hurt our team." Finley told him to make the deal and gave him a 48-hour deadline. Torrey ignored it, and Finley fired him. Torrey sued and won. He left the team and accepted an offer from another expansion team, the New York Islanders. Today, Torrey is special advisor to the general manager and alternate governor of the Florida Panthers. Charlie Finley was also notorious for not paying his players what they were worth. In 1970 to 71, his first year with the Seals, Ernie Hickey scored 22 goals and 25 assists. Dennis Hextall, his centerman before he was traded to Minnesota, scored 21 goals and 31 assists. That summer, Finley started negotiating with Ernie. As a rookie, Hickey had made $10,000 his first year. Finley offered him a $1,000 raise. Hickey called Dennis Hextall and found out that he was making thousands more. So when Finley called back and said, "Ernie, how are you doing? Have you thought about my offer?" Hickey said, "Yeah, Charlie, yeah, I've thought about your offer. I'm not gonna accept it." "Why not?" Hickey said, "Well, Hextall was on our team last year. I scored more goals than he did, and he's getting $55,000. And you want to give me $11,000? Finley said, "Well, the only thing you can do, Ernie, is you can go to arbitration in Montreal. I'll be there, and so will NHL President Clarence Campbell, and he won't give you another dime. In fact, you'll lose $1,000 because you've got to pay for your flight there, your hotel, and your meals." Hickey flew to Montreal and went in, and for the next hour or so, he made his case to Clarence Campbell. Campbell listened and then said, "I don't even really have to wait on this. You're getting what Finley offered you." Hickey said, "What? Are you kidding me?" Campbell said, "Nope, that's it. End of conversation, end of meeting. We'll see you at training camp." The next season, 1971 to 72, the Seals had a completely different team. All great young players like goalie Gilles Meloche, Joey Johnston, Carol Vadney, Jerry Pinder, Paul Schmier, and Bobby Sheehan. Only four guys on the team were over 25. Gary Young came in as the GM, and Vic Stasiuk was the coach. The team played really well, and Charlie would sometimes go on road trips with them. In October 1971, Meloche stopped tons of shots, and the team beat Boston 2-0. Charlie came into the dressing room and said, "Okay, we're going to New York tomorrow, because I'm going to take you to Gucci. I want to buy each of you a nice pair of Italian shoes." Later, they played the Rangers and beat them 2-1, and again Charlie came into the dressing room. "Unbelievable, guys. The limos will be there tomorrow morning. We're going to the Burlington factory. Everybody gets a trench coat." You never knew with Charlie. For Christmas that same year, all the wives were given recycled pendants that were inscribed, Oakland A's, World Champions 1970. When the WHA started up in 1972, most of Charlie's players jumped over, and so the nucleus of that team was gone. The WHA was offering much more money. Dennis Sobchuk, a junior star with the Regina Pats, who was drafted 89th overall by Philadelphia in 1974, made $1 million when he went to the Cincinnati Stingers in 1975. The same thing happened to the Oakland Athletics in baseball. Charlie lost his top hitter, Reggie Jackson, and future Hall of Fame pitchers Catfish Hunter and Raleigh Fingers. Reggie Jackson led the league in home runs and hitting, but Charlie didn't care. His attitude was, "Go to New York, I'll get some other players." In 1973 to 74, the Seals ended the season 13-55-10. The NHL stepped in and bought the team from Charlie. The team was a drain on league finances until they were sold to San Francisco hotel owner Mel Swig, who moved them to Cleveland in 1976 to 77. They were called the Barons and lasted just two seasons before they were folded into the Minnesota North Stars. But that is not to say that hockey had no place in the Bay Area. The San Jose Sharks have one of the loudest rinks in the league today. The same can be said for Minneapolis-St. Paul, which lost a team, then got one back. Or Denver. Or Winnipeg, for that matter. When a team goes under, people say the problem is the market. But that is not necessarily the case. Often, when we say that one market is better than another, what we mean is that one team is better than another. No one wants to see their home team get embarrassed every night. Eventually, they are going to stop coming. If the Seals had been on a level playing field with more established franchises, they probably wouldn't have left in the 1970s. Maybe the same can be said for the Cleveland Barons and the Kansas City Scouts. If teams have the right support from the league, and if they do the right things to reach out to their communities through charities and youth hockey programs, I don't see why hockey shouldn't thrive anywhere sports are played. Chapter 22. The Pittsburgh Penguins. My father was a big believer in education. He hated the idea of his kids missing school for any reason. But in early September, he would let me miss one day a week. That was when the Pittsburgh Penguins would be holding their training camp in my hometown of Brantford, Ontario. For 4 or 5 hours a day, I would be in the stands, just amazed at how big these guys were and how fast. What may have made the strongest impression was how incredibly hard they worked. No one was standing around out there. They were going flat out the whole time. The other thing I thought was, that looks like a lot of fun. One year I was in Pee Wee, I scored 400 goals, which was also pretty fun. Somehow, the Penguins heard about it, and I was invited into their dressing room the next September. There were about 15 guys in the room, all sweaty and doing push-ups and tossing around medicine balls and things. I was a shy kid, and a little bit intimidated by all these huge guys in matching sweatsuits. But then one of the more intimidating guys came over to shake my hand and take me around the room to introduce his teammates. His name was Glenn Sather. Of course, I would learn a lot from Glenn over the years, but the first lesson came the first time we met. It meant so much to me that he would go out of his way to welcome a nervous kid, and I never forgot it. For my whole career, unless I'd had the worst day of my life, I always took time to talk to the kids who just wanted to meet some of their heroes. When they first looked at expansion, the NHL decided to add not only two West Coast teams, but also two from the Midwest and two from the East. Buffalo and Pittsburgh were competing for the latter, but Pittsburgh had the inside track. Pennsylvania Senator Jack McGregor, who represented 21 investors, called on his friend Art Rooney, the owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. McGregor offered him a minority ownership in the Penguins, and then asked him to make a call to the Norris brothers, who owned the Wings and Blackhawks. Rooney got them to swing the vote Pittsburgh's way. Once they got the franchise, McGregor hired Jack Riley, a well-respected former minor pro player, to be GM. The owners told Riley to follow a win-now approach and draft proven players, not rookies. Riley hired ex-Rangers coach Red Sullivan, and over the next couple of years, they secured a number of former Rangers. The most famous of them by far was Andy Bathgate, who had played 10 years in New York and had actually tied Bobby Hull in the scoring race in 1961-62. He also won a cup with the Leafs. The Penguins also picked up ex-Ranger Brian Hextall, father of goaltender Ron Hextall, in 1969. His father, Brian Hextall Sr., had been one of the top Rangers in the late 1930s and 40s, and is a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame. Brian Jr. was a hothead and would jump in to protect his teammates. That may be a family trait. I don't think anyone who ever played against Ron thought he was the kind of guy who would shy away from confrontation. If you spent too long near Hextall's crease, you'd have bruises on the back of your legs to show for it. By 1973-74, Pittsburgh was building by getting skilled players in the draft, but one of their main problems was toughness. Now, they did have some agitators who would stand up for the team, guys like Bugsy Watson, who pound for pound was one of the toughest guys in the league. 7 years earlier, when he was with Detroit, he shut Bobby Hull down in the playoffs, and Glenn Sather, the Oilers' future coach. And yet, in an era where Philadelphia had the Broad Street Bullies, St. Louis had the Plager Brothers and Steve Durbano, and Boston had the Big Bad Bruins, the Penguins were getting pushed around. So in the late 1970s and early 80s, Pittsburgh brought in more toughness. During that era, and in my era too, the tough guy had a role. He was part of the makeup of a solid team. You had your offensive guys and your defensive guys, and you had a couple of tough guys. There was a guy named Kim Claxon who played for a number of different teams and ended up in Pittsburgh in 1979-80. He looked like a choir boy, but he was the only guy who ever scared me in hockey. At 5'10 and 195 pounds, he wasn't exactly a beast, but he was mean. Kim wasn't afraid of anyone. He wouldn't try to fight me, but he would try to run me. To him, it was like scoring goals. I always knew who was on the ice and where they were. I also liked to stand opposite the opposition bench. That way I could count everyone in front of me. And in Kim's case, I wanted to make sure I knew where he was at all times. That's paying him a compliment. Guys like that get paid to make you think about them. Claxon used to eat at a place called Alexander Graham Bell's in Market Square in downtown Pittsburgh. The bar manager there was Ho Hum, a Vietnamese immigrant. Claxon gave him tickets to watch us, the Oilers, play the Penguins on January 19, 1980. It was Ho Hum's first hockey game, and he was sitting two rows behind our bench. In the middle of the second period, we dumped the puck into their corner, and I came up to forecheck. Their goaltender, Greg Millen, was covering up the puck, and Kim was in front. Kim got his stick up on me as I came in and clipped me across the forehead. I was a little bit shaken up and stayed on the ice for a moment or two, so the Edmonton trainer came out to see how I was doing. Now usually, a player will escort the trainer over so that he doesn't slip on the ice. That night, a couple of my teammates left the bench, and one of them was Dave Semenko. It was already a chippy game, and Dave was never very forgiving about guys taking liberties. It wasn't long before he and Claxon dropped their gloves. Dave was throwing bombs and had Claxon on his knees, but Claxon wasn't backing down. Somehow the linesmen got them apart and into the penalty box, but they weren't done. Both guys had plenty more to say, and finally Dave had enough. The benches had cleared by this point, and even the goalies were squared off, and no one was watching the penalty box, Suddenly, Dave swings his leg over the boards and goes at Klaxon. The funny thing was, standing in the box, a few inches above the ice, those extra few inches made Klaxon seem as tall as Dave. They threw a few punches while Klaxon was still in the box. Then he jumped back out on the ice and they started throwing again. The linesmen separated them, and Klaxon got free yet again, and the two renewed hostilities. Eventually, they were separated a third time and led away to their dressing rooms. But Klaxon had other ideas. As soon as the refs' backs were turned, he calmly put his helmet back on and skated back out onto the ice, and challenged any oiler who was willing. Dave Hunter was game, and away they went. When Glenn Sather saw Klaxon on the ice, he picked up a water bottle and threw it at him. Suddenly, someone behind Glenn tried to come over the glass. It was Ho-Hum. In his hand, he had a big open safety pin full of keys, and he was holding it like a knife. As Glenn was moving back and forth trying to dodge the safety pin, Klaxon picked up the water bottle and started spraying Glenn, who was wearing one of his hand-tailored wool suits. This went on for a couple of minutes until the police grabbed Ho-Hum by one leg, pulled him off the glass, and handcuffed him. A week later, Kim drove over to Alexander Graham Bell's for lunch. He sat down, and Ho-Hum came over. When Klaxon offered him tickets to the next game, Ho-Hum just shook his head. Hockey got off to a rough start in Pittsburgh. It's tough to win when the odds are stacked against you, and it's tough to learn how to win when the tradition isn't there. For a long time, the Penguins seemed destined for the same fate as the Seals. The igloo was full of empty seats. The team had declared bankruptcy once, and a lot of people expected them to relocate. They lost a lot, and they did not draft well. But every once in a while, a guy comes along who is magnificent enough to completely change a city. When the Penguins got their chance to draft someone like that, they made no mistake. On his very first shift in the NHL, Mario Lemieux robbed future Hall of Famer Ray Bourque of the puck, skated in on net, and buried it. It was his first shot as a pro. Not a bad start for a franchise that hadn't had a winning season since 1979. He scored 100 points as a rookie and 141 in his second season, which put him in second in the scoring race. In his fourth season, he scored 168 points and beat me in the scoring race. There was pretty much nothing Mario couldn't do. He came within a point of scoring 200 points one season. He had an 8-point game in which he scored in every way a player can, even strength, power play, penalty kill, penalty shot, and empty net. He was so powerful and so smooth that he could do whatever he wanted out there. Imagine being so good that an absolute legend like Jaromir Jagr is the second best player on your team. The Penguins were barely holding on when the magnificent Mario arrived. It wasn't long before the Penguins were one of the most intimidating teams in the league, and now they are easily one of the luckiest. It's one thing to be able to draft Mario and Jagr to one team. Now they have Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. Today, Mario has his name on the cup as both player and owner, the only person ever to do that. But that kind of dominance seemed a long way away in 1967. Chapter 23. The Philadelphia Flyers. Whenever a player is interviewed after winning the Stanley Cup, the first thing he does is thank his parents. There's just no way anyone makes it to the NHL without an unbelievable amount of sacrifice and support. And it's not just parents. It's all the coaches and volunteers that keep minor hockey running. I certainly was very lucky in the way my parents brought me up and helped me along. There's no way I could thank them enough. My parents gave me every opportunity to succeed, and when I was 14, that meant leaving home. I wanted to play for a team in Toronto called the Young Nationals. Anyone who has played minor hockey at a serious level has probably come across a young Nats team at a tournament somewhere in North America. A ton of great players have come through that program, including Paul Coffey, Mike Gartner, Larry Murphy, Eric Lindros, and more recently, Tyler Seguin and Jeff Skinner. You can see why my parents thought that playing with the Nats would be a good opportunity for me. They signed over guardianship to a Toronto couple, Bill and Rita Cornish, so that I could live in Toronto. They were unbelievable to me. Over the years, we became very close. I showed up for school in September, but a week before the season started, the Ontario Minor Hockey Association suspended me and another kid named Brian Rohrabach on the grounds that I was not entitled to play in Toronto since my home address was down the highway in Brantford.